Thank you for those wonderful readings from the Sunday school, members of our Sunday school. My name is Athol McLagan. I am a lay member of the Central Methodist Mission. Currently I'm the treasurer, and together with Adrian and Tony, we make sure that the monies that come into the church are dealt with as procedure would have, and that there's open transparency. Prior to being the treasurer, I was helped out at the service dining room. And the reason why I'm talking to you today is because Alan is busy cycling. And last year, I took part in a hike in Namibia. I joined friends from Johannesburg, and we went off walking in Johannesburg. In Namibia, in the Namib Desert. And I came back throughout the experience. I felt very, very held, very much when we read the psalm today. I felt very as if I was really cared for, despite being in a very far, remote place with very little food and water and very harsh conditions. Not once did I feel scared. I just felt that I was in the right place, the right time, doing the right thing, that wonderful feeling. And I came back and I said to Alan, what is it about deserts that bring this out in people? When you visit deserts, what is it about the desert that sort of, it's almost unlocks something in your spiritual world? And Alan, his typical side, said, I don't know, but come and think about it and come and speak to the congregation about it. And that's what I'm here to do today. And it ties quite nicely in with the biblical rhythm that we go through each year. Last Sunday was Transfiguration Sunday, where we listened to a story about how our lives are a series of valleys and mountains. I'm a gardener, and I look after two gardens. One is in the Constantia Valley, and the other one is in the kennel, in the Kenilworth area, also in a valley. And you know, as gardeners, we love to garden in valleys because the soil is deep, it's protected from the southeaster. It's a comfortable place in which to create a beautiful garden. But I know deep down that every now and again I have to get up and walk up Table Mountain, because when I walk up Table Mountain, I'm reminded of reality of where we really live and of the plants that grow naturally without all the work that comes with being a gardener. And I never fail to come off of the mountain completely inspired to garden differently within the valleys. And so that's what Transfiguration Sunday is all about, understanding that it's good to be in the comfort zones, but every now and again we need to move out of those zones and either return to our valley or cross a mountain range and enter the next valley of our life. So that was last weekend's sermon. And then on Wednesday we acknowledged Ash Wednesday, and which is a time when we remember Jesus goes out into the desert on his own private spiritual retreat. And so hopefully my journey ties quite nicely in with the biblical rhythm that we are in at the moment. But before I go on tell you about my journey, I would like to acknowledge the role that this congregation has played within my own transfiguration since I've been coming to worship here with you. I walked through those doors almost 4 years ago, and when I at that point, I had a very, very simple, oversimplistic view of what Jesus and the Jesus way was all about. Here I was on earth, and I believed that up there, somewhere above the blue sky, was heaven. And there was Jesus and God. It was very white. It was very male. It was a place where everyone gardened. There wasn't much war going on. Lots of vegetarians, it was quite a happy place. And down below me was another place called hell. It was dark and black, and it was a place that I was scared of and tried to avoid desperately. And I was caught between these two, trying to avoid hell and trying desperately to please heaven, and always feeling a terrible failure as a result, filled with shame, filled with guilt, and feeling quite lost along that journey. Then I walked through those doors and started listening and sitting on these pews, singing with you, and things started to change for me. And one of the most pivotal stories that came from this platform was when I was challenged to think that rather that there was heaven up there and hell below and me caught in between, that perhaps heaven and hell were right here on earth with us, and that Jesus and God was in me and every single person around me. When I heard that, a very deep truth button got switched on within me. It was almost, it was a revelation. I understood it. But when you've been stumbling around in the dark for 40 years, and suddenly a light goes on, it's a bit blinding. So what I understood the story. It meant something to me, but I didn't quite know how to translate that into my own personal life. After the sermon, I walked across town to the service dining room. And for those of you who don't know, the Central Methodist Mission was involved with providing a meal for the homeless of Cape Town. And that happened every Sunday. And it operated from the service dining room in Canterbury Street. I walked up there with the sermon in my head. And I knocked on the door and looked down the passage to where the kitchen is at the building. And there was a man dressed in a white shirt with a tie. He had neatly pressed pants and polished shirts and polished shoes. And he was busy dishing up food. And there I saw Jesus. And his name was Ivan, Uncle Ivan, the most remarkable individual. There was Jesus. Suddenly, that sermon made sense to me. And so I started going back to the service dining room. And then another transformative thing happened to me, in that I started to work with, I realized that Jesus was as much a woman as a man. I met Anita, Ursula, Alma, Pam, Dee, Haley, Megan and her tattoos. I met Leanne, all these remarkable, capable women. There was Jesus. It was a completely transformative moment. I learned that Jesus was completely pedantic when I met Anton, who was determined that things happened and had to happen in a certain way. And I learned that Jesus also loved washing dishes, because there Neville was in the back every Sunday cleaning the pots and pans that we'd made. But the biggest transformation took place when Uncle Ivan went and opened the door, and Jesus came flowing in the door with all the homeless people, the children, the women and men who called the streets of Cape Town home. There was Jesus. And I learned that the Jesus way is a messy, chaotic, and you can swear. And the most remarkable thing is that it completely changed my idea that the Jesus way was just like me, messy, chaotic, unpredictable. And when I got that, it suddenly made sense, because suddenly all my shame, all the guilt that I had, I suddenly felt understood, because there Jesus was around me. So yeah, it had a completely transforming effect on me. Also, the service dining room looks across a vacant piece of land, which during the week is used as a car park, an informal car park. And on Saturdays and Sundays, it just remains a rather sad-looking piece of land. And strangely, in the one corner is a gabion, a metal cage. And in it is filled with building rubble from homes from District 6. And as a white South African, I was completely aware of the story of District 6 and Sophia Town, but it was only through working at the service dining room and seeing it and coming here to worship with you that I really started to understand the full implications of what the forced removals meant to people. It suddenly became real. And this church in which we sit today in worship was where the white Methodist worshipped, and the church across on Batenkon Street was where the Cullen and Black Methodists would have worshipped. And above the Batenkon church is a little plaque, and I really would recommend that you go and read it. Whenever I'm in town, I always try to pass by and read it. And because what it says is the following. It says, "All who pass by, remember with shame the many thousands of people who lived for generations in District 6 and other parts of the city and were forced by law to leave their homes because of the color of their skins. Father, forgive us." And it really hit home that in the 80s, when you walk in the church, there's a cross, and it is made up of a pew from this congregation and a pew from the Batenkon congregation, because in the 80s, they were joined together. And that came with all sorts of dramas. And I've learned that it should have been my people, my tribe, that got up off of these pews, made tea, and walked across town to the Batenkon church, knocked on the door and said, "We are here to worship with you." And today, this church should be a museum for District 6, and we should all be worshiping at Batenkon Street. I firmly believe that. And it is only through sitting on the pews here with you, singing with you, listening to the stories that come from this lectern, reciting the benediction of disturbance, that I have been able to change, and I thank you for that. But now to the desert. As I said, last year I went on this walk. It's in the Namib Narkluf Desert. It's a 120-kilometer trek through a very tough part of Namibia. It's probably the toughest physical thing that I've ever done. You had to carry all your gear with you, carry your food, your sleeping bag. The shelters at night were very, very primitive, very simple. There was water, but you had to pump it out of one of those hand pumps. And I sat there and over the time learnt four very valuable lessons. The first one was when I read that, you know, ahead of time, obviously sat and I did some research, and I was told that the Namib Desert is the oldest desert in the world. Now, I didn't really understand that. How could one part of the earth be older than another? I just didn't get that. And then it was explained to me on this hike that deserts are places that have undergone change. They weren't always deserts. So millions of years ago, a desert that we see today may have been a vast inland lake or sea. It might have been a forest, might have been an open savanna. Deserts are places that have undergone change due to climate change. Sometimes it has been a dramatic change, other times it has been a very simple, gradual change that has turned a place from one type of vegetation to another. And it got me thinking. It got me thinking in that deserts clearly are places that have undergone change, and with that comes an experience and a knowledge. So in other words, deserts are places that have great wisdom. And when you walk into them, when you into the environment, it's very difficult not to be infected by that energy, especially if you open to it. And it reminded me, it's a little bit like when you're in the presence of your grandparents or elders. The reason why those people are important is because they have a history, they have a knowledge of change. And with that comes experience. They know who they are. So yeah, the desert was just simply an old, wise place in which I found myself. And with that, I was just infected with that energy. It reminded me of my grandmother. I only had one grandparent, my grandmother. She was a remarkable individual, and she had played a very important role in my life. She was a controversial woman. She'd been married to my grandfather. He died young. She'd had an affair. She'd had an illegal abortion. She tried to commit suicide. But when I got to know her, when I met her, she would have been in her 60s. She knew herself. She was a wise woman. She'd experienced all these changes. And so when I came into her world, she provided a very stable, rock-solid understanding about who I was. My parents were in their 30s at the time, so they were still finding themselves. And it made me understand that it's terribly difficult to be a good parent. Because when you're being a parent, you're finding yourself. How can you be a good parent? But you can be a remarkable grandparent. And I think grandparents are incredibly and play a very, very important role in our children's lives. You don't have to have grandparents, though. Not all of us are blessed with having grandparents, but it's the elderly that we must seek out. So it's old places and old people, remarkably valuable places to be. The second thing that I came to terms with, I was having lunch on the third day. We were sitting down to lunch, and had been climbing through a steep gorge, and we'd stopped halfway up, and across us on the other bank was a mountainside of Kurkerboom. I'm sure you probably know the Kurkerboom. It's well known in the north. If you travel up to the Northern Cape and into Namibia, they become very well known plants. So they're tree aloe. And it was remarkable to see this entire bank, or this entire mountainside of Kurkerboom. And they were in full flower. As we were sitting there eating my lunch, I noticed that some of the trees were very beautifully shaped. Old, some of them right close, next door were very sort of had been battling. They were much smaller. And it was almost like the luck of the draw that certain seeds had fallen in areas that were very, where the soil was a little bit deeper, the plant could get its root through a crack, whereas others were really battling. So there was a great variety amongst the plants. They weren't all the same, but they were all flowering. That was a remarkable thing. Even the stunted small ones had produced flowers. And I just look back at my own actions that morning. I'd done nothing but moan all morning. Moaned about the fact that we were sleeping on a very hard, rocky floor. Moaned about the fact that we had to get up at 5:30 in the morning. Moan. Moaned about the fact that there wasn't, it was steep going. Hill, why we had to climb a mountain, Moaned about the fact why I'd chosen to spend my holiday hiking instead of somewhere comfortable. Moan. And I kind of sat back and I thought, none of those aloes are moaning, despite the varied conditions. They were all flowering. And it made me think that in this world in which we live today, we are bombarded with the message that we are special. Somehow, if you open any magazine, watch television, adverts, if you're on social media, everything is about that you are special. And it got me thinking that is a very negative thing to, because I thought I was special, therefore I was moaning. And when I thought, okay, just let me think about this. Because when you think that you're special, it tends to manifest itself in two ways. Either you think that you're entitled. I'm special, therefore I'm entitled to. And we see that in politicians, we see that in the clergy. And that's not healthy. It isn't healthy at all. There's a flip side to it as well, in that when you think you're special, you can also act as a victim. Also, very destructive quality. You're not accountable for your actions when you're a victim. And I think a perfect example that I can think of is Hansi Kronier. You know, if we think the devil made me do it, it was a complete cop-out. He was a victim, you know. Instead of saying, yes, I did it, and I'm prepared to accept the responsibility for that, he put the blame on someone else. It wasn't him. Both are very destructive qualities. So what I'd encourage you to do is to stop telling your partner, your wife, your husband, your children that they're special. Rather tell them that they're unique. Wonderfully unique, beautifully unique. Because that's what those aloes were telling me, that each plant was unique. I think that's a much more healthier approach to life than thinking that you're special. Because when you are when you understand that you're unique, you then understand your role within this world in which we live. So the group that I was walking with, I had a unique role to play. I was good at certain things, mediocre at quite a bit, useless at a lot. I had absolutely no sense of direction. If it was left up to me to work out where we were going, we would have still been walking around the Namib Desert. And I've sort of come to think that maybe Moses had that same problem as well. I fulfilled a unique role within that group. And the minute I didn't fill a special role, I filled a unique role. And I think that's a far more healthier understanding to have. The third lesson that I learned in the desert was because we had to carry our food, it was a 7-day hike. Because we had to carry our own food, obviously you're limited by the amount of what you can take with you. You have to weigh up weight versus hunger. And so on the trip, I ate very simply, very, very simply. And also drank mostly water. And the most remarkable thing started happening because I started to feel very healthy by eating less and by simply consuming less. And I think what it has to do with, I'm not a doctor, but I sort of think what I had to do is that when you eat food, your body sends all its energy to digest it and to process it. And we eat a lot, I certainly do, in my day-to-day thing. So your body spends most of its time processing food. And when you give your body a break from that, it's remarkable because then it can use that energy to do other things like heal and dream. And so by eating less, I suddenly, my body seemed to be able to fix itself up because I was just simply consuming less food. So it had an opportunity to sort that food out, but then it had a chance to do other things. And I really I got to understand the importance of fasting and how important fasting is to the growth of my spirituality. It can be simple. It can be simply taking a break from food one day a week. Or it can be more extreme where you maybe take off a week where you decide to go on a fast. It's a very, very, very healthy thing to do. And I think that's part of when we think of Jesus going out into the desert for 40 days and where he found his own truth, I think part of that might have had to do with this extreme fast that he went on. So I really would encourage you to think about the idea of fasting. It really does. It certainly had an effect on me. And the last thing that I that sort of made an impact on me on the desert, because it was a physically challenging experience, we had to get up at sunrise every morning, we walked all day, we'd get home, or we'd get to the next sleeping spot at about 5 o'clock in the evening, and then it was a case of having to cook and get, you know, get your sleeping bag out and get ready for the evening. By the time 8 o'clock, we're all ready for bed. We weren't allowed to make fires because of the very sensitive environment in which we were in. So by 8 o'clock, boy, I was in my sleeping bag on the rock, fast asleep. And I found that I would sleep very solidly for about 4 hours. So from about 8 o'clock to midnight. Then I'd wake up and I had the whole midnight to 5 hour thing to have to deal with. But a wonderful thing happened because it was almost as if my body got a very, very deep sleep. And then in that second phase of the night, I started to dream, had the most amazing dreams. And what I decided to do, I'm not sure if my fellow hikers either found it incredibly irritating or funny or enlightening, but I used to tell people about my dreams. I'd wake up and I'd say, you'd never guess what I dreamt about last night. And they were quite odd, but I vocalized them. And I suddenly understood the amazing thing about where our dreams take us. When people say, you know, dream, dream big, dream it, I always tended to think outside of my, you know, of my body. So dream of becoming something, dream of going somewhere. I never thought of the idea that actually the dreams are all in within me. Honor that, listen to that voice. Dreams are incredibly powerful things. You meet people in dreams. You go places, you can do things in your dreams. It's just the most remarkable world to be. And somehow, we sort of lost touch with that side of us. When you go into a place where you do have lots of rest and sleep, suddenly your body kicks into this thing where your dreams become much more apparent to you. And I've started writing my dreams down and sharing them with people. Telling them, even if they sound completely mad, I tell people about my dreams. And slowly, a rhythm starts to develop. Your dreams teach you things. They're there. So, yeah, that was the most remarkable thing, was just to acknowledge my dreams, my own dreams. My dreams weren't out there doing other things. They were within me. So that is my story. And I'd like you to join me in prayer. Just before we do that, though, just to say, after our worship service, we are going to have tea. Tea has been set up in the back. Please join us. Hopefully stay a